It's when you get involved, that's when the relationships can be built. But it's when you sit back as some sort of armchair warrior, just looking at what your side pumps at you, that's when you get more and more angry.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, you're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. That is the UK's leading Christian magazine, bringing you a variety of perspectives every month on the things that matter. You've joined us for The Profile, where we sit down with a different Christian every week and hear something of their story. And I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show a past guest in Andy Flanagan. Andy is a musician, singer-songwriter, he heads up Christians in Politics and so much more. And one of the reasons that Andy and I are speaking today is the latest issue of the magazine is guest edited by Green Pastures. And Andy has done some work with Green Pastures in the whole field of homelessness. And we're going to dive into that subject as well as other issues related to justice and politics as we go today. So Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Sam. Great to see you, sir.
Well, it's lovely to catch up. Now, I mentioned in the introduction, you're a musician, singer-songwriter, you're involved in politics, you're arguably a lobbyist, you're a theologian. I mean, is any of that how you actually see yourself? And do any of those identities actually take precedent one over the other?
I don't know. The one that looms largest at the minute is just dad, really, with an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old. Most of my time is spent just being dad. And walking them around and driving them around. So yeah, that looms largest at the minute. Jubilee and Jesse steal most of my heart. But yes, I've always been passionate about the sort of stuff you mentioned. And, I started off as a doctor and then got called out of that into the world of music. And then a lot of the songs that I was writing started to get used by folks like, NGOs like Oxfam, Christian Aid, Tear Fund. Because a lot of the songs I was writing were having found out about the state of the planet and the state of the global economic system and the injustices of it, started to have a bit of a rant in song. And so those songs started to be used. They would take me away to see sweatshops in Bangladesh or Christians being persecuted in Egypt or orphanages in Uganda. Go away, tell the story, write the song, and hopefully raise a level of awareness back in you about those things. So it's been a journey.
So take me back to that moment or those moments where those issues of justice became were on your radar as a Christian, where actually you then started to write songs in that vein. I mean, something must have happened to you to make you want to write songs about those subjects.
Well, I mean, a good example is the one I just mentioned, actually, in Bangladesh. Spending a lot of time, we were investigating garment factories in Dhaka, especially. You know, so I think in those days, I think the figure was like 5,000 garment factories in Bangladesh. You know, so many of our clothes in the high street come from there. And sadly, in those factories in Dhaka, you would see folks, we actually were at the end of production lines where labels were being stitched on that said made in the UK, made in Germany, made in the USA. They were blatantly being made in Dhaka, often by children, often by folks who were, living in the most cramped conditions, leprosy, big issue still. And, it was really sobering to see that stuff. But it was even more sobering to hear the stories and start to understand a little bit more about why Bangladesh was in the state it was in and why there'd been this rush of folks from the countryside into the city, into these cramped conditions and rammed into this sort of urban industrial economy in a land that's actually designed for doing subsistence farming. And it goes back to what happened when we arrived, when the missionaries and the British arrived, and we said, hey, you don't want to be making all that food just for yourself. You don't want to be just doing subsistence farming. You want to be creating, plants for indigo dye for us because we've got this industrial textile revolution going on. Make the dye. And we convinced, sometimes under duress, a lot of those folks to do that. And so a lot of folks weren't then making food for themselves and just farming for themselves. And then we actually found somewhere cheaper to get it. And so we left and we disappeared and we stopped paying them for the dye and the bottom fell out of their economy. And that's why, from that moment onwards, it's been a fairly impoverished nation. And so you hear about stuff like that and it's incredibly sobering because you think, well, gosh, there were loads of missionaries and Christians who were part of that wave of people who went to that country who probably had very sincere motives, But you're thinking all the time, gosh, they had this massive blind spot to what they were doing to this country. And you're thinking, well, what, you know, in 50 years' time, what are we going to look back on in our day and think, you know, what are the blind spots that we had in 2025 that we didn't stand up and speak about, or that we were actually even complicit in?
I mean, I think about some of the Christian initiatives, even in my lifetime. You could argue that if there has been a blind spot in the church around justice and global issues, that not that all that's been fixed necessarily, but that we've come a long way. I mean, I think of things like Make Poverty History. I think of things like the Jubilee campaign. I think of organizations like Tear Fund and Green Pastors, which we're going to talk about, and others, which are all, these are all organizations that are now very prominent in the church. You've been writing songs even that address these sorts of issues. So there is a kind of positive outlook on all this that says actually the UK church understands issues of justice far more and far better today than we did, say, 30 years ago. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think that was an incredible time. You know, the late 90s, the Jubilee Debt Coalition, we were really leading the narrative at that point. The church was bringing these issues to the forefront in society, and that was an incredible time. But I really do worry now that where we've got to now, we're in a much more selfish place. You don't find people, and you know, a lot of the time it's not even an internal thing. You know, when you look at the cost of living crisis and you look at the time people are spending, people having to do two jobs, everybody in the family working, a lot of the time people just don't have the headspace to think about what the state of the rest of the world, when actually the rich are still getting richer and the poor are still getting poorer all across the world. The effects of climate change on the poorest in our world, massive, bigger than even back 30, 40 years ago. Yet somehow we're a lot more silent on that stuff now, because I think we're becoming a little bit more selfish. I think it's what's happened through lockdown. We've all become a little bit more anxious, and we're all just trying to look after ourselves, just trying to keep the show of life on the road. And it's totally understandable, but it does lead us to be less outward focused. And I would say sometimes there's been a shift also in where our preoccupations lie, that we are trying to protect ourselves rather than actually open ourselves up. You know, sometimes the question has to be asked, you know, I think, does God care more about the state of our hearts than our security? You know, we're building walls around ourselves to protect ourselves. And you've got to think, well, what if God cares more about our openness to the other than he cares about our security? Because actually sometimes in times of trial and in times when we're in awkward places, uncomfortable places, that's where we grow as believers. That's where we grow. That's where the discipleship happens. I've seen that happen in my life. And you know, when you go away in a team, you get in an awkward position, you put yourself out of your comfort zone, that's when you grow. And I fear, especially in the West now, we're just trying to build walls. We're really good at what I call sort of, you know, suffering avoidance mechanisms. And so much of the public discourse is about our security, keeping ourselves safe, keeping the other people out. And we need to think sensibly about that. But we are losing track of actually maybe what we're fully called to. And, you know, the God of hospitality, this goes back to the theological root of God being a hospitable God, making room, a God who made room for us at the table. So are we making room for the other in our lives, whether that's somebody who's, you know, an island that's disappearing because of climate change, or whether it's folks in sub-Saharan Africa who are still struggling with an incredible impact of climate change there? You know, or whether it's the immigration discussion, you know, are we making room in our hearts for the other, or are we allowing what has changed in the last 30, 40 years is this wide wave of polarization that has hit us, that has made us, separated us, the social media algorithms that are separating us and actually causing us to blame the other rather than look inside ourselves and realize that we're all to blame for some of the problems of our world.
Isn't some of the problem there, you talk about safety and security, you work with Christians in politics, you know, it's often said that the first job and duty of any prime minister, any government, is to keep their people safe. Now, is that wrong from a Christian perspective? Do you say actually that shouldn't be our first priority? That's why issues of security and safety and immigration can be so polarizing, is people say, well, it is the job of the government, not necessarily to go help all these people in other countries. It's the job of a government actually to keep their own people safe.
Some people might say that. If you're wanting to make that argument, that is what you will say is the most important. I think we're called to lead. I think as people in public, we are called to lead. We're called to lead in the way that Jesus led. You know, Jesus could easily, you know, you think of Palm Sunday, when Jesus rode in on a donkey and everybody cheering, and the children of Israel are finally going, yes, finally, Finally, somebody who's going to throw off the oppressive Romans. Finally, somebody who is going to get rid of those others. And he could have ridden that wave of lazy populism. He could have ridden that wave, but he chose not to, because real leadership is leadership that takes us beyond our prejudices, that takes us beyond our blaming of the other, and actually makes us realize that there's stuff wrong in us as well. When Jesus started to say, actually, no, the problem's in our hearts as well, the problem's in us, and he started to point out what the kingdom of God was really about, that's when the folks went, no, we don't like that so much. Can we have Barabbas instead, please? You know, that's the reality of what we're seeing playing out all over our world right now. It's the lazy leadership of populism, where we blame others, and the other is becoming more other. I mean, I see this because I come from Northern Ireland. You know, I know where this story goes. I know where this ends up, because we have our red, white and blue pavements, and we have our green, white and gold pavements that are marking our territory and saying you are the other, and we're actually living separately within the same country. And you see this happening in the United States right now. You know what's going on, the political violence, Charlie Kirk, that tragedy just even in the last few days. You see what's happening there. That's where this goes when we other people and we stop interacting. And so the challenge for us as believers, as Christians in politics, is to be those people of reconciliation that bring people together, that refuse to believe that the others are to blame, that refuse to believe that the others are somehow morally inferior, that refuse to believe and actually take some responsibility for our culpability in some of the situations of our world. You know, talking about the issue of immigration and security, you know, that's why we have to take the image of the issue of climate change so seriously. Climate change is going to continue to create more and more refugees and asylum seekers over the course of the next few decades unless we address that. And that's a massive part of actually helping our security, of helping protect the people, as you started with in that question.
You mentioned the divisive nature, the polarization of our politics. I imagine some Christians look at this and debates around immigration, around housing, and they sort of throw their hands up and just think, why get involved at all? And that's a question you've written on, spoken on for a long time now. And I'd love to know what your current answer is to those who say, you're right, Andy, it is divisive. It is horrible out there. That's why I don't really want to touch this political stuff.
Oh, I have huge sympathy for folks who accurately spot that that's what's going on. And it's more in our faces than it used to be. Previously, when folks got involved, they would gradually realise that. But people are, it's coming at them through their social media feeds straight away. They can see how divisive things are. But actually, the point of hope and the point of light is that when people get relationally involved, when people get involved in a local council, I have the privilege of receiving emails and phone calls from folks who are getting involved as Christians, as local councillors, and who have the wave of Christians who entered Parliament last year. When you actually hear from folks who are getting involved on the ground, getting to know people who they don't necessarily agree with, and starting to work with people who they don't necessarily agree with, when you're actually physically in the fight, when you're in the midst of it, that's when you realise that people are humans as well. That's when you start playing sport with people from another party. You play five-a-side football in Parliament with people that you don't actually agree with on everything. You know, when you get involved in a local council, you're involved in a local planning committee with people that you don't necessarily agree with on everything, but you realise they're human and you actually end up going for coffee with them and they're not three-headed monsters after all. It's when you get involved and that's when the relationships can be built. But it's when you sit back as some sort of armchair warrior, just looking at what your side pumps at you, that's when you get more and more angry. That's when you get more and more relational. And I'm sadly watching the radicalization of so many of my peers who, because they're just armchair warriors and not actually physically getting involved, they're getting more and more angry. And the stuff they're posting is getting more and more angry. And it's getting less and less informed because it's not drawing from a wide range of sources. And that's the dangerous thing. But the point of encouragement is that, you know, for folks who have been involved in Christians in politics for a long time, you know, we put together all these prayer triplets back in, 2014, 2015, you know, intentionally folks, one yellow, one green, one blue, one red, you know, the triplets were all multifactorial, you would say. But as those folks have prayed together regularly and got to know one another, it's been amazing to see how that has changed their public tone, changed what they say in public, changed what they write on their literature that goes through the door, because they've got dear friends that they're praying with that they know they can't just slag off the other side or lie about the other side or make up things about their side, because they'll be seeing that person next week and they'll have to answer for it. So it's massively changed and improved the tone of the communication of those people. So I guess we always hoped that's what would happen. But what we didn't see coming, which we probably should have seen coming, what we didn't see coming is that those people have actually become far better politicians than their peers. They have been promoted far more quickly. They're shining because in our current polarized state, we are really raising up generations of people who are brilliant at being shop stewards for one side or the other. You're great at banging the drum for the broadly progressive side or the broadly conservative side. Great at banging that drum, great at rabble-rousing. But when you expose these folks to the actual oxygen of a public debate, when you expose these folks to actually meeting and trying to persuade somebody else of something else, they can't do it because they've not been rubbing shoulders with people they don't agree with. And therefore, they haven't learned to listen and they haven't learned how to frame their own argument to persuade somebody else. So these folks who have been living and breathing with people from the other side of the aisle are actually proving themselves to be far better at politics. And we shouldn't be surprised at that, because it's God's way. It's the kingdom way to do that. And so that's the joyous thing that we're still seeing with the Christians who are getting involved. But you're not going to read that in the headlines. You're just going to read what's tragic and scandalous in the headlines. So I would say to people, don't give up hope. Get stuck in, get involved. It's the best place to be. It's the place to actually protect yourself from cynicism is by being involved, and protect yourself from tribalism is by actually being involved. It's false to believe that by staying out of it, we will somehow stay holier than thou and away from it, you know? And my bath has never got cleaner by me staying outside it and shouting, be clean, you know, only by being involved. And we're not staying outside the system by staying outside it. You know, we are, people will also, sorry, you got me on a rant now, Sam, but you know, people often say like, Andy, love what you do, bless what you do, Andy, but, and you know, there's a but coming when somebody says
yeah.
That. But like, I really fear that if I got involved, I would get polluted. I would get corrupted. And then you have to sort of smile and go, look, can I let you in on a secret? You already are polluted. You already are corrupted. You know, I could talk about the crystals in your mobile phone that are supporting some fairly shocking, slavery in sub-Saharan Africa. I could talk about your mortgage. I could talk about that may well be, you could talk about your pension, supporting the arms trade. I could talk about the petrol you put in your car that's supporting some fairly shocking Middle Eastern states that are oppressing Christians and oppressing women. You know, we're not separate from this world system. We are fallen. We are complicit in this system by our wallets, which is even more than our voting. You know, we are complicit. We are polluted. So the question should never be, should we get involved? We are involved. The question is, what are we going to do now that we are involved?
Yeah. It strikes me as well that one of the things that happens if you're not quote-unquote involved, so you're not physically engaged, but you are maybe reading headlines or you are posting on Facebook, and you mentioned some people that just get more and more angry. It strikes me that what happens there is, because you're not involved in the complexities of the political debate, you think there's an easy answer. And you see this on the left and the right, and you see it in anger of, why don't the government or why don't so-and-so just do XYZ, as if there's a simple fix. And I suppose for those who are properly politically engaged, helping volunteering to serve their local political party or getting involved in the local council, those people tend to understand that there are nuances and complexities, and there aren't really easy answers to almost anything in politics. And I wonder if that's part of the problem, that if you're not involved, you do think, because you're only reading headlines on social media, that other side are idiots and they should just do X, Y, Z. Whereas the more politically engaged you are, the more you realise that life is complex, and if it was an easy problem to solve, we would have solved it by now.
Yeah, absolutely right, Sam. Preach it. You should take over now. No, absolutely right. And I would say the other thing that dynamic brings is a sense of responsibility and a sense of leadership. You have no response when you're just firing off stuff from your armchair, when you're firing stuff off online. You can say what you want. You've got no responsibility. The perfect example of this is what happened in the 90s in Northern Ireland. Do you remember the horrendous deaths and the standoff that happened in Drumcree, my hometown, Portadown? And, you know, for a few years, there were these massive protests going on because there was an Orange March wanted to go down a certain road that did not want to welcome it. And so there was a crowd of people camped out a Drumcree churchyard. Remember this? And basically, the nation came to a standstill. People were putting up roadblocks. There was vigilante stuff happening everywhere. It was absolute carnage. And but David Trimble and Ian Paisley, at one of the years, they finally got to walk down the road in a walk of triumph. David Trimble and Ian Paisley walked up Portadown Main Street with everybody, all the Protestants, you know, cheering. And but 2 years later, David Trimble had become First Minister of Northern Ireland. He was given responsibility. He was actually running the country in cooperation with Seamus Mallon, who was his deputy. 2 years later, that same situation happened. And rather than walking in the front of that parade up a main street with lots of just one side cheering, he was sat at a press conference behind a desk officially as First Minister with his deputy right beside him, telling people to get off the streets and to de-escalate the situation. That's what responsibility does to people. When people actually have to take up leadership, there is, we're all made in the image of God. This is what we have to see. This is how we get away from the othering of the other. We are all made in the image of God. It's become so easy to just blame the other. Unless we have, you know, we've got to have believing that there is the divine DNA in every single one of us that is being called out, that this leadership can rise up in people. This, when you give people responsibility, it's amazing how they grow into that leadership and responsibility. So we've got it. This all comes back to the theology. We've got to believe that we're all made in the image of God, but we've also got to believe that we're all fallen, that sin is real. Without a theology of sin in the public square, we have nothing left to do except blame whole groups of people. We have to blame the bankers. We have to blame the politicians. We have to blame the media. We have to blame the immigrants, because we haven't got a theology. We haven't got a framework for saying, actually, as Solzhenitsyn famously said, the axis of evil runs through every human heart. That actually there is, yes, we are made in the image of God, but sometimes through our bad choices or through stuff that happens to us, that image of God is scarred and crushed and twisted and turned and not looking so good. But we've got to keep looking out for it in each other. We've got to keep doing that.
I feel like we've established some brilliant ground rules at this point. So we can't blame others. We have to take responsibility. We called as Christians to be leaders, to rise above some of the polarization that we've seen. We have to be politically engaged. We are politically engaged, which sets us up really nicely to now talk about a specific issue. The latest issue of the magazine is guest edited by Green Pastures, who are a Christian charity working in the area of homelessness. And Andy, I know you've done a little bit of work with them. So do you want to just start by telling us a bit about Green Pastures, this issue of homelessness, and how you first came across this charity, this organisation, and what you've been doing to support them?
Well, when I was regularly going to party conferences and trying to help people investigate this issue, Green Pastures was one of the organisations that we had come along, because we knew that they were working with folks trying to solve homelessness in localities. And that group, that work has now grown, you know, working with over, you know, 1,000 partners around the UK. It's incredible to see what's happening with all the people that are now being housed. Green Pastures simply buying a property, but doing it in conjunction with a local NGO or a local church to make sure that those folks who are put into that house are really well supported, and that they're actually, we're not just trying to put a roof on their head, around their heads. We're not just trying to put walls around them. We're actually trying to build community around people, because we all know, we've all encountered and had interactions with folks who are homeless and who are really struggling. And we all know the transformation hasn't got to just be external. The transformation has to be internal as well. Stuff has to shift in terms of behaviour, in terms of relationships. And that is really, in my experience, really only possible when somebody's part of a sustainable community, when somebody is part of an accountable, sustainable community. And the church provides that in the most powerful way. You know, you've got wonderful examples all over the country of that having happened. So my interaction with Green Pastures started then, and hearing about their work. And then, and part of the reason that they're able to buy these houses is that they encourage Christians to invest little bits of money. If they've got some savings, rather than, you know, putting savings into stocks and shares, and you don't know ethically where that stuff being invested, you can actually invest. You know, in our case, it was just, I think it was £3,000. We invested £3,000, and that becomes a little package that gets layered up with all the other people investing £2,000-£3,000 that allow Green Pastures to buy a house. But you're investing it as a loan, so it's a way of investing. So if you can either keep after 3 or 5 years, you can keep your money with Green Pastures, and that helps them to buy more houses, or you can actually get your money back, but with interest. So it's a way of making using the reality of our current housing market and the current housing situation to encourage a lot more people to do what you might call ethical investment. And through that, lots of people are getting off the street and getting into community.
Hi, it's Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm proud to say we are celebrating our 60th anniversary. From our beginnings as Buzz in the 1960s to the vibrant multi-platform magazine we are today, our commitment to connecting faith with the world around us has never changed. To mark the occasion, we have a special offer of 12 months for half price. That's just £24 for print and digital access. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com. Automatically renews at £47.99. I think what's interesting about this is the dynamic of it, as you say, that it's a way of putting your money to it's a way of thinking ethically about your money and where your money goes, which I think is something that's very practical for us as Christians to think about where our money is being used. And this is one way of using your finances in an ethical way. On the point though about how we as a society view those rough sleeping or homeless, can you speak to that? Because I think there's been a lot of talk about showing compassion to refugees, to asylum seekers, to migrants. Some people have said, yes, absolutely, we should, but we should also show compassion to people in our own country who have nowhere to live. Now, I'm sure you wouldn't want to pit those two groups against each other, and it's not a war of who we can be most compassionate towards. But there has been a bit of an argument there to say, well, hang on, before we can talk about immigration and people coming in here, we haven't looked after people in our own nation that well. In fact, arguably, we've looked down on them and we've marginalized them and we've not given them the time of day when people are rough sleeping. Would you agree with that analysis?
Well, I think I'm going to be really careful about a false equivalence there. I think it's very, very rare that people making that argument are folks who are actually involved in working with folks on the street. You'll find those arguments are being made by armchair warriors, very few of whom are actually involved in, you know, locally or nationally in the fight against homelessness. You speak to the folks who are actually involved in the work in homelessness and they're not saying, oh gosh, I wish we were getting more funding because everybody's busy looking after folks who are coming to this country from another country, often, you know, getting away from war. The reality is nine out of 10 folks who are getting into new tenancies in the UK are British born. It's a very small percentage of folks who are, and it's incredibly hard to access housing when you're coming as an asylum seeker. Even, you know, it's very, very hard. Even if you do eventually get accepted to be a refugee, you know, you think it only 28 days to get all your paperwork in order. So very few folks who have gone through that system actually end up doing anything to impact the social housing provision. So there's a real false equivalence between those two things. It's like all the folks who are involved do not see that as an issue at all. It's a lazy political, casually racist equivalence, I would say, to be honest. But I do agree with you that we have a job to do. We do need to put our own house in order and we do need to look after the people on our streets. And, you know, the church is doing an incredible job of that. The church is really well placed because of our ability to resource and our ability to build community around people, as we said earlier. So you think of there are so many Christian NGOs all over the country that are doing that are making an incredibly good job of this. And I think And through this whole thing, I think we have to be thinking seriously about what it does for us, not just about what we need to do to address that issue. You know, Jesus always was talking about what being on a mission with him, what it does in us. He always is concerned about his mission in us as well as his mission through us. And, you know, time after time, the folks who are involved in Crossline, which is a weekly soup kitchen here in Exeter, you know, what the change in us, how our hearts are softened, how we're really made grateful for the privilege of being able to invest in green pastures. You know, that's such a privilege to even have some money to be able to invest, but you're made aware of that by rubbing shoulders with these folks who are really struggling. And sometimes, you know, they've made some pretty shocking choices, but sometimes who are on the streets through no fault of their own. But you're made aware of where you sit in the scheme of things, but you're also, I feel like when we get to know folks, we are getting to know the heart of God. You know, I often tell the story of washing the car with my dad. You know, that was the highlight of my childhood. It was on a Saturday. I would My dad would come into the house and he would say, "Andrew, it's time for you to help me wash the car." And I would swell with pride because my dad needed my help to wash the car, and I used to love it, getting, suds, soap, everything everywhere. I used to absolutely love it. And but it was a few years ago, I sat in the church when a preacher was talking about how he'd been washing the car with his son the previous day, and he said, "And you know what? I was washing the car. Yeah, we were doing it Saturday afternoon." And I sort of sat up in my seat thinking, "Oh, I remember that. That was lovely. That was great." And he said, "And you know what? It was a nightmare. He got stone in the sponge and he scraped the paintwork. The whole process took a lot longer because he kicked the bucket over and we had to refill it." And I was just like, "Oh." I was like, it's just a little child again, like the carpet pulled out from under this beautiful memory that I thought, well, why did my dad ask for my help washing the car? And yeah, as it's already come to you, it clearly came to me that my dad wanted my help because he wanted me to be where he was. He wanted me to be getting to know him in the context of a shared task. He wanted me to be getting up to what he was already getting up to. And so similarly, like our Heavenly Father all around the world is healing the sick, bringing sight to the blind, releasing the oppressed. And he simply is calling us to be where he is. That's how we get to know him in the midst of those places. It's not just academic, learn something, read it in the morning. We learn through experience. We learn, we meet him in the eyes and the hands and the faces of the broken and the marginalized and the lonely rich of our world. That's where we meet him. Matthew 25, "And as much as you've done it to the least of my brethren, you've done it unto me." That's not just a nice idea. That's reality. That's like being with him in the midst of his broken world, getting to know his broken heart for his broken creation. And that's why this engagement and this involvement, it's just so essential.
And it has to come from that place, doesn't it? It has to come from that place of God's heart is broken for something. God, break my heart for what breaks yours. And it has to come from that place of love, of compassion, of the heart of God for people. Otherwise, it turns into just, well, you're a project and I can help you and I suppose I should do the right thing. But if we get the motivation right of this is on God's heart, I want it to be on my heart. Your service to God then comes from a completely different place, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. And it also stops us becoming workaholics. I've got too many friends who are involved in NGOs, are involved in this sort of work, but they're just really tired and depressed and not really praying much anymore. It's because so often the needs of the world are so huge and the state of the world is so it's so troubling that we just start to believe that it's all on us, when actually, Jesus very clearly said, John 5:19, "I only do what I see the Father doing." There will be particular things that we are called to do, but we can't solve everything. We can't solve trafficking and abortion and homelessness. And, there will be a particular area that God calls us to, that we can focus on, that we can get to know his heart in the context of that issue and with those people. But I just see a lot of people who are paralyzed by the amount of need. But Jesus didn't meet every need in the village. He didn't go to every village. He did what he saw the Father doing. He was strategic and he was spontaneous. Do you know he was organized, but he was organic. So he would, yes, he would respond to need, when somebody came up to him, but he was saying, but a lot of the time he said, no, we're going on to the next village. The disciples are going, no, this is going really well, Jesus. You're really popular. Let's stay here. And he's going, no, we're going on. There's a plan. And so he only did what he saw the Father doing, rather than just meeting every need. That's not what he was about. And so we get into really dangerous places, the church, when we feel like we have to meet every need, we have to do something about everything. Number one, we won't be expert enough to do something about everything, but we also will just get absolutely knackered. And so, yeah, it's only doing what we see the Father doing, and coming from that heart and that place that we know that actually this is important for us as well as for the people that we're hopefully helping. And gosh, sometimes we don't help. Sometimes we make things worse, but actually we learn in the process, and maybe next time we will help a little bit more.
Can you tell me just personally if any of your own kind of prejudices over the years have been dismantled by practically working in this area of homelessness? Like, what's the personal impact it's had on you as you've met people in very different circumstances to your own? And what are the things you've learned through doing that kind of work and that kind of ministry?
A wonderful Scottish fella called Michael here in Exeter, who part of the Jen, my wife, and I just set up this wee with some friends, like this homeless choir, and gosh, it's not that it was in any way very successful, but there's these beautiful moments of being with Michael and his partner and the various other people that came along, singing Yesterday. All my troubles seem so far away. Now, just these beautiful voice, beautiful harmonies, and just seeing you when you're singing with somebody, it's in a very different place. They're like, oh, functionally, I must help them. They are hungry. I must give them food to eat. There's just something about trying to share some life with people. It's so easy to reduce people to these pawns who are part of our programs and another number. That we hit a target of the number of people that we've helped, and we can talk about that. Actually, it's a totally different thing to actually be in relationship with people in a way that actually costs us. Because when folks are just part of a program, we can just go and visit, and we can come back, and then we go back to our own comfort. When we actually are getting into a relationship with people, that's when it starts to cost us. And I think, when Jen and I were living in the council estate that we lived in South London, we were really aware. We were following the example of some incredible people like Ash and Angie Barker, now living in Birmingham, but at the time were living in a slum with their kids in Bangkok. And I'm really inspired by that these folks were just like enmeshed in relationship with those who were in need, not just sort of in a sterile way going once a week to give them something at a food bank or to give them something. They were actually living, rubbing shoulders, doing the incarnational thing with these folks. It's so inspiring, just so inspiring. So I guess part of what we were trying to do when we were in London was to do exactly that. But there's this that's when you're changed, that's when you're shaped, that's when you realize your prejudices, when you actually get drawn into real relationship with folks. And that's when I realized so many of my presumptions were wrong. And when you actually see the genius and you see the beauty and you see how intelligent somebody is that you had just written off as somebody who was just struggling,
I'd love to zoom out a bit about the wider issue of homelessness and take us back to those COVID years. And my memory of this was very early on in the pandemic, we solved the issue of rough sleeping. And many, many councils, I think, provided space in hotels for people who were on the streets to have proper accommodation. And of course, a lot has changed since then. But it was one of those incredible moments where you think, well, actually, arguably, if there's the political will here, quite a large change can happen almost overnight. I mean, is that your perception as well? That actually, if we really believe we want to solve the issue of rough sleeping, there are houses, there are places to go. We did it during COVID. Although it was temporary, could we do it again? Could we actually solve the issue of rough sleeping?
Possibly in collaboration with NGOs and with churches. It's not something that can just be solved by politicians, but I think with the political will, it is possible. I think you're starting to see some improvements in the last year or so where we actually have a plan to build more houses. We can't get in talking about homelessness without talking about the massive need for more homes, 300,000 per year. At least we now have targets. We've got new targets for local authorities that actually have to adhere to these targets for building new houses. We're streamlining the planning procedures, and we're drawing people in, we're drawing developers in a way that makes it more amenable to them as well. So there are strategies in play to help build more homes, because we blatantly need more homes. That's where this whole thing starts. And that's where some of the other injustices, homelessness is just it's just sort of the tip of the iceberg. The cost of living crisis that is affecting the UK, most of that comes down to who owns the land and who owns the property, and we are in a different place to a lot of our European partners here in this. It's the cost of living massively affects us because housing is like so 40% more expensive here than in the rest of the Europe. The other things that we buy are like we're about eight it's around about 8% more expensive, but housing is 40% more expensive. We have no disposable income. That's why we have a cost of living crisis. So the homelessness thing is just the tip of the iceberg of this. We have a real problem with housing, and we need to build more houses. And the opening up that's happening recently into the grey belt, as it's called. The less desirable bits of the green belt that actually we're building can happen now. So we can't talk about this without talking about housing, and that's not going to happen overnight. But we also have to be honest about the fact that. Some of the reasons for homelessness cannot be solved politically, because that is always going to continue to happen. The relational, the family breakdown, and some of the some of the unhelpful personal decision making that happens, that's not going to be changed by a magic wand where everybody's suddenly going to be better at being a husband or a wife, or domestic abuse is going to not be happening. You know, we can't imagine those things away. Those kind of sad societal things that are actually very personal things sometimes that come from folks not being taught how to, you know, if you ask me for a silver bullet that would affect so many issues across the political spectrum, Sam, it would actually be parenting. Parenting classes. That's what I would love to see. That's what I would love to see us invest in as communities and societies. I think that would be a massive thing.
It's interesting you say that, because a lot of Christians would have said the same thing around family breakdown being a huge cause of a lot of these issues. There's something arguably Christians have been saying for quite some time, that fix the family and you fix a lot of other issues.
Well, it's both and. And the problem, the tribalization is, like, you know, the broadly conservative crowd will say, just sort that stuff, just fix the family. And the broadly progressive crowd will say, it's all structural. Let's build more houses. You know, it's both and. So often it's both and. And the tribalization of our public square doesn't allow us to have the nuance of saying, well, actually, yeah, I agree with this over here. But on this thing, I'm more over here.
Well, thankfully, we're part of the solution, Andy, because you've spoken about both those things in one interview today. So hopefully we can try and bridge the gap. You know, you've spoken both about housing and you've spoken also about family breakdown, societal issues. It leads me nicely onto a question about homelessness and different sort of pieces of the puzzle, or different people trying to help solve it. So we've spoken a bit about government, but I wanted to ask you, what's the unique place of the church in this? You know, what are the things that we as the church, we as Christians, can or should be doing that maybe government can't do or government isn't quite as good at? What's the unique place the church holds in trying to tackle this issue of homelessness?
Oh, there are many things that the church can do that, a government body can't do. We go back to what I was saying earlier about internal transformation. You know, we have had some real progress in the last few years in talking about holistic transformation, that's what we long to see in people. We long to see holistic transformation, not just transformation. We don't want to just put double glazing on people's houses. We all the massive investment in council estates, unless something changes internally, the behaviour and what happens in that estate will be exactly the same. So we're longing to see internal transformation. We all know that you can't just go to the gym. It has to be something internal as well. There has to be a drive to make things better and to be making better choices, that actually we need that internal transformation. So it's got to the point now where we're actually in the corridors of Whitehall and local councils, rather than the language of sort of, you know, oh, that's the evangelism stuff and that's the social action stuff and these are separate. And partly sometimes Christian organisations did that just to get funding and sort of soft peddled the actual faith sharing aspect of what they were doing in a way that left a whole generation of folks in Whitehall and in local councils sort of illiterate about the fact that we are actually wanting to share our faith, that we actually are wanting people to come into a community of faith where that transformation is sustainable. But we're now actually able to talk about holistic transformation. We've got better language for it to talk about holistic transformation, so that actually you can say, you can be on the front foot, and if somebody is making a proposal or a council is making a proposal to invest externally in a certain area with a new facility or to invest with something else, we can say, yes, that's great external transformation you're bringing, thank you for that, but where's the internal transformation going to happen from? Because unless the external and the internal transformation are melded together, this is not actually going to have the breakthrough that we hope for. And so it's getting on the front foot to be able to say that in 100,000 places around the country. Christians are starting to do that and actually really challenge government and providers to say, where's the internal transformation coming from? And quite often people then go, okay, oh yes, yes. Yeah, you guys can help us with that. Actually, because you can provide community and because you're actually encouraging people. The whole process of discipleship is about living better. It's about living better and making better choices in our lives. And that has a huge impact. So that number one, there is that. But number two, you've got this incredible volunteer base of folks in the church. You're never going to have enough therapists. You're never going to have enough homeless workers provided being paid to solve the problems, to solve the massive problems that we have in our country. You know, you apply that to the mental health crisis as well. You know, there's never going to be enough professional people to help, but actually we can train Christians and we can train other volunteers to be involved just enough in a way that actually provides groups, that provides groups that support people mental health wise, that provides groups that actually support people finding a community. You look at what folks like Hope into Action are doing, Green Pastors are doing. It's incredible how that is facilitating well-being groups that actually can walk people into better choices, can walk people into community. So again, you've got this great volunteer base. I could go on. The church can do so many things that will never be able to be provided, but that shouldn't stop us trying to form our own little world. We should be constantly doing what we're called to in that space,
yeah,
and also lobbying, also saying, yes, but we need to build more houses. Yes, but we need to be more open. Yes, we need to have better regulation and legislation in and around mental health. You know, it's both, and it's the personal and the political always.
Yes. I think it's really good that we, you know, as you've just acknowledged, Christians are doing so much in this area already, the kind of volunteer army that you were speaking about. We often don't talk about that. I wonder if it's perhaps because we don't want to blow our own trumpet and we are called to humility. We often don't talk about that. Hey, if the church disappeared overnight, so much youth work provision would go. Pretty much every toddler group would go. A lot of the homeless provision is either being done by Christians or by charities that were founded with a very strong Christian underpinning. I guess we don't like to blow our own trumpets. We don't talk about that so much, but it is important to acknowledge the amount that the church is already doing in this area of homelessness is really quite remarkable, isn't it?
Knowing that there is a large army of people, that you're not on your own, that there is a bunch of people doing that, that's a real incentive to do what maybe you're getting a nudge, what you're getting a calling to do. You know, if you're listening to this, if you're thinking, gosh, actually, there are these organisations that have developed expertise like Green Pastors in this area. So I'm not just going out onto the street and doing something random and doing it randomly and doing it on my own in a way, you know, I'll do it for as long as I've got energy for 6 months and then I'll stop doing it again. Well, the fact that there are folks that have gone ahead of us in some of these callings that we might have means that we can step into these callings with a level of expertise and a level of confidence, and we'll be that much more effective when we do so.
What gives you hope in this area? Because I could list off a load of stats about how everything's getting worse, not just with homelessness, but with lots of the other issues we've spoken about today. What keeps you going and what gives you hope as a Christian to keep plugging away, even when the numbers and the trends seem to be going in the wrong direction at times?
I think it's back to that Genesis 1 calling thing, Sam, that actually our metric is not our success or the success of the world. That, you know, back in Genesis 1, you know, we are called, made in his image, to be stewards of this place. That call that Adam and Eve received, you know, to be stewards in creation, not over all of creation, not just the human creation. And the fascinating thing about that call in Genesis 1 is that it happened before anything went wrong. So that call, it's a divine vocation. It's a holy calling. It's not just a response to carnage. And there's a dangerous thread of theology that's kind of wandering over the Atlantic from the United States at the minute that says that politics is just a necessary evil to constrain evil. You know, this sort of libertarian thinking that says, you know, this is just like, we'd rather we didn't have to do this politics stuff. We'd rather we didn't have to do this governance stuff. But I guess because it's a fallen world, we have to, you know. But the reality is it's actually a divine calling. It's a holy vocation that before anything went wrong, Adam and Eve were called into this work. That actually it would appear that even perfection needed managed. And we're promised that, you know, and it's our apprenticeship for the future where it's promised we will be ruling and reigning with him forever. So this is
right. I was thinking that there's an eschatology here as well about in the future we're ruling and reigning, and that sounds kind of political in a way, doesn't it?
And that's what we're doing. This is our chance to apprentice in the meantime. And so the wonderful thing about that is that so we don't turn our eyes to the carnage and we don't turn our eyes away from all the stuff that is going wrong, but we do realize that our metric for what success is different. That we are here because of the Genesis 1 call. It's to image his rule and reign. It's not just to fix something that's gone wrong. It is to image his rule and reign. And when we are called to image his rule and reign, at times that will lead us to be popular and to have success. and it will look successful. But at times that's going to look like failure. At times that's going to look like being taken down by social media. At times that's going to be being written out of the public square. At times that's going to look like something that was beautiful and right, but just didn't work because of this opposition that happened. You know, that. But we are called to image his rule and reign. We're not called to fix everything. We're called to do the little bit that we're called to, you know, doing, again, what we said earlier, doing what we see the Father doing. But we're called to image his rule and reign. That's what we're called to do. We're not here just to fix the world. That's not the calling. We're called to image his rule and reign. And sometimes that will look like success in the eyes of the world, but sometimes that will look like failure. And so we need to be really careful that we don't allow the constant bombardment that we now have through the internet of all the stuff that's going wrong everywhere. Number one, that's not an accurate representation, because the news will always pivot towards what is tragic and scandalous. And the news can't help itself being what it is. The news is news. It's by definition, it's new. It's novelty, you know, and often the novelty thing is not the thing that's good. It's the thing that's different. It's the thing that changes. It's the thing that's scandalous. And so we need to make sure that the news is not our only information stream, that we're drawing from ancient wisdom. So the big problem in modern society is that we've made the news our only information stream. When the news is designed as a, you know, the news is a valid thing, but it needs to be in a little chunk off on itself, while we're also drawing from deeper wisdom. We're drawing from community. We're drawing from what we hear from other people. We're drawing from ancient wisdom. We're drawing from scripture. We're drawing from wider reading. We're drawing from the beauty and the joy that we see in creation when we go outside, that we can't allow this news stream to become the whole thing, because we will get depressed if we do that, and we will become paralyzed. So number one, we need to be careful what we're taking in. But number two, we need to be aware that our metric is not success in the eyes of the world. Our metric is imaging accurately and as well as we can his rule and reign. And sometimes that's going to feel like we're making progress, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's just demonstrating. We're not called to build the kingdom like we're building some sort of secular progressive utopia. We're not called to build the kingdom. We're called to demonstrate the kingdom. Jesus just demonstrated the kingdom. Again, he didn't heal everybody in the village. He didn't go to every village. He just demonstrated in these beautiful moments what the perfect future was going to look like. And so we are called to demonstrate that perfect future. That might be just helping one person, helping three people. Might not be fixing homelessness in our town, but it might be making the difference in somebody's life. That's demonstrating the perfect future. That's demonstrating it, erecting a signpost to say another way is possible. It makes me think of my, using the word demonstrating makes me think of my chemistry lessons at school. You know, where you used to expose some sodium or magnesium or potassium to the oxygen, and you'll go, you know, and that's happening on a very small scale compared to the industrial scale that you're learning about in some industrial plant somewhere. But it's still real. It's still sodium oxide being formed. It's still potassium oxide being formed. In the same way that Jesus' miracles were real, they were absolutely real. People were absolutely transformed. But it was like small scale compared to healing everybody in the world. And so it's a demonstration. It's a beautiful firework, a beautiful color that says another way is possible. And so I think that's a really important thing to bear in mind when we look at the state of the planet. It's like we're called to demonstrate. We're not called to build it. Like on our shoulders to build it up to this future perfection. We're called to demonstrate the future perfection, and that would be just little moments and bursts. And yes, we want to make that as big as possible, and yes, we want to help as many people as possible, but actually the call is to demonstrate, not to build.
So we've spoken a bit about Green Pastures and the various ways you can get involved. One of the things they allow you to do is to, as a church community, step into this whole area of homelessness. Can you explain a bit about how that works and how it could be an option for a whole church to come together on this issue rather than just an individual?
Well, what's happened in so many places around the country is that Green Pastures have brought their expertise and actually the funding, the central pot of funding that they have from both national and local investors to actually buy a property. But then they ask that church to come as the community that supports the folks who are in that property. So sometimes these properties can have, you know, if you get the right property, you can have like 10, 12 people in them. But then the church comes around those folks, or a group of churches come around those folks to be the supportive community that then allow those folks to be undergoing some internal transformation as well as external transformation. And, you know, you hear story and story, testimony after testimony of folks who have got off the street where that has been so profound. You know, there's this lovely guy called Magnus in Exeter who had housing provided for him. It was actually in this context, you know, similar situation by the YMCA. And you talk about when he found community coming off the street. Actually, he's 7 foot 2. And so they had to make a bed for him, 3 pallets. They had to make him put 2 double mattresses on it. And he's a blacksmith, amazing guy. But 2023, he got kicked out of his house and found housing. And now he's actually, through the time he spent there, he's managed to get into university. And now he's actually back volunteering with the YMCA, helping other people, wanting to give back, wanting to helping other people get off the streets. And that's, you know, we haven't talked so far about the epidemic of young people ending up on the streets, you know, which is an even scarier thing sometimes than the adults that we see on the streets. So, you coming around, it's that supportive community that once we get, you know, the important thing is getting people off the street. And so these houses, the green pastures especially provide, are absolutely vital. Having somewhere safe for people to go, but then having friendships and relationships that spin around that house and support people and provide community for them is absolutely wonderful.
And community is such an important thing that the church and green pastures are providing. You think in an increasingly individualistic age in the West, in an increasingly lonely age, it's actually an element of the gospel, isn't it? That it is kind of more attractive at our particular cultural moment than perhaps it has been in the past, because we do live in societies that are quite disconnected, that can be quite lonely, where people don't naturally have the community that other people in other parts of the world do. So how vital is that for what Green Pastors is doing in providing that community? And how much can Christians learn from that, even in the way we behave as the church and what we try and model to the world, that it's not just me and Jesus, but actually he wants me to be in a community?
Well, yeah, you look at the example of the early church. This is exactly what happened. You know, when you read, it's like, it's exactly what I wanted to do, to remember the poor. That's what Paul said. And so the early church were famous for everybody finding a place and nobody being left out, and everybody finding a home, and everybody finding folks who had nothing were offered something. And so it's part of our DNA as believers, right from the start of the church, that's actually what made people come running towards the church, was the fact that they were providing for people. I would say, you know, the two major factors, what I'm praying for in our city here, is that there would be these wild supernatural things happening, you know, like there was at Pentecost. That's a hallmark of the early church. And the second hallmark of the early church that made people run towards them, was that people were being provided for, that there were no poor among them. And you know, that's so appealing. So what you're saying is like core to the gospel and so appealing. Yes, people are wowed by signs and wonders and supernatural signs, and we long for more of that. We long for people to be healed and delivered, because this stuff's always spiritual as well. You know, I'm you know, being involved with homelessness, you see a little bit of you see a little people who have been really oppressed by some fairly dark spiritual stuff through what they've been exposed to. And so, you know, it's both, and it's like it's wanting to see that supernatural breakthrough, but also folks finding what we'd call home, finding that place where they're looked after and they know they can relax and start being the person God's called them to be, and knowing it where no one was in need. So it's those two things. I guess that's my prayer for the UK church, that we actually clear away all the rest of the rubble and the madness and the trying to impress everybody with our big lights and our big screens, and then go, right, okay, we long to see genuinely supernatural things happen, and we long to see a situation where people run towards us because they can sense that if they're coming towards us, that they will not be in need, and that we will give of some of what we have, the huge amount of resource that we have, and spread that out so that more people can be in that place of safety and that place of welcome. We do it because we follow a hospitable God, a God who made room for us at the table. So we try to make room at the table for others. It's as simple as that.
Amen.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.